Hey folks, it's Rob Wolf. I'm in a new office. I have Jim Dandy, new internet, and this is episode 189 of the Payless Solution Podcast, and I've got my ever large and in charge co-host, Greg Everett, flying with me. What's going on, dude?
Not much. Monday morning, running a little behind, scrambling to get onto the podcast.
Fudge, dude. Mondays are just, well, maybe if I didn't completely schlaz out on Sunday and Saturday, then Monday wouldn't be so bad, but
I feel like Mondays would be better if I schlazed out more on Saturday and Sundays.
Yeah, there might be something to that.
But who knows? So we'll never know.
What's new? What's exciting? Tell folks.
What's new and exciting is that we, meaning Catalyst Athletics, launched our weightlifting certification and gym affiliation program.
Nice.
On last Thursday. Well, that will be two Thursdays ago by the time you guys are listening to this. Really excited about that. That's been in the works for literally like 4 or 5 years now. It's kind of ridiculous. Something we've been asked to do for a long time, and I just haven't quite knuckled down and done it, because I was obviously, the biggest concern is quality control with that sort of thing, and I didn't want to half-ass it or three-quarter ass it or anything less than 100% full ass it. And so it took a long time to kind of decide how exactly we wanted to do it, and now I think I've settled on a system that I think is going to work really well, and that is going to be as reliable as it can possibly be in ensuring that the certification is actually meaningful, and that the affiliation is meaningful, and people can actually trust that name, and because it all comes back to me, and I don't want to look like a dickhead. I already make myself. So
nice.
So you can get that catalystathletics.com/cert. You can read all about it. You can register for the certification seminars, which is the first step. You got to attend a seminar and then do some test taking.
Nice. And then yeah. Purchase some PVC and a Dynamax ball, and they're in, right? They're like fourth level Jedi certified at that point.
Yep, that's it.
Cool.
We will certify you in having a valid credit card.
Did you want to mention any gyms that have met the criteria yet? Are you letting that out? Or
yeah, well, interestingly enough, NorCal Strength and Conditioning, owned by Mr. Rob Wolf,
shocker,
and Mrs. Nikki Violetti. Or Mr. and Mrs. Nikki Violetti.
Yeah, pretty much, as she wears the pants in the family, so yeah.
Let's see here, Michael Rutherford's gym out in, oh God, what is it? What is it,
Lenexa.
Prairie City, Kansas?
Is it Prairie City or Lenexa?
He just corrected me the other day, and it's Prairie something.
Okay.
Prairie Plains or Prairie, some kind of prairie place in Kansas, which, as I understand it, is pretty much the entire state of Kansas.
Yeah, I think they have a hill somewhere where there used to be a garbage dump, and they made
probably made the hill to do sprints on or something.
Probably.
We've got a lot of other great coaches on board too, like Bob Tacano, Jim Schmitz, Paul Fleschler, Danny Camargo, Sean Waxman, and so really the affiliation program. The whole point is that we want to be able to have a network of gyms who we feel provide really high-quality weightlifting coaching, but not just quality, but in line with the way that Catalyst Athletics does things. So, coaching and programming that's compatible with what we believe to work well. And so, all these fantastic, amazing coaches who are all way better than me have agreed to be part of it, and they're all people that we refer to anyway, so it's a great group of people to have on board. And if you're looking for a cool gym to go train on, that list of places is going to keep growing and growing, and looking forward to it.
Cool. Well, and generally I would say that the route to success is surrounding yourself with people who are both better at things than you are and smarter than you are. But I can think of a glaring example of a huge deviation from that, and I still can't fucking wrap my head around it. But I still think that this is a great move on your part. So congrats, and we are honored to be an affiliate gym. And we've been motoring along with a no lifting program that is largely derivative of the Catalyst Athletics programming for gosh, I like 4 years now. So three and a half, 4 years. So very Sweet. Honored, very excited.
Awesome.
Sweet.
And that's about all interesting I have in my life
cool.
to talk about.
So performance menu for our show sponsors, performancemenu.com, Journal of Nutrition and Athletic Excellence, $30 a year for the base model, $100 a year for all the back issues, under the hood, fun. Anything else about performance menu that I should throw
out? Oh, yeah, that premium subscription, the $100 one, you get a 15% discount code for the Catalyst Athletic Store.
Nice.
So you can just go wild.
Cool.
You can read performance menu issues and articles all day and buy stuff at 85% of retail.
Nice. Cool.
That sounds like a party to me.
I like it. I like it. And then we have wellfoodco.com. Go to wellfoodco if you need grass-fed jerky, grass-fed whey protein, you know, gluten-free, snacky bar type gigs. We have some very interesting items coming out with Well Food Company here pretty soon. Who else do we have? FrontDeskHQ.com. Go to FrontDeskHQ for all of your service-based business solutions, dog walking, hair stylists. We just had something new, like a large Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu federation is looking at making Front Desk HQ the basic solution for all of their gyms. So
nice.
That's very, very exciting.
It will also work for Brazilian waxing.
I am sure it would. You know, front door, back door,
front desk, back
yeah,
desk.
Front desk, back desk. You know, it's all good. So, and actually, you know, I'll just can that. So the last episode, I went completely off the rails. So what? This is going up next week. I have a feeling when we may have significantly fewer listeners on this episode compared to last episode because I went completely off the reservation on some stuff. Speaking of off the reservation, our final podcast sponsor, the Bunny Ranch. Go to bunnyranch.com. Check out all the great, pleasureful things that Dennis Hoff and his gals have brought to the world and continue to bring to the world. You know, it's a brothel outside of Carson City, so keep in mind that there's porn and boobs and naked folks associated with this deal. So, you know, don't read this on your smartphone during, say, like church services or something like that. So there you go.
Nice.
Cool.
All right.
So Squatchy put together a pretty nice little setup here today.
Yeah.
I think.
Let's see here. Both of us read this first one incorrectly, and it's about waking up, not about walking.
Yeah.
Okay. Michael says, Dear Messrs. Wolf and Everett, very formal, I'm English and so far too reserved and up my own ass to tell you what a great podcast you do. It's not bad, I guess. I had a question about going into ketosis as we sleep. I read someone say that we wake up in a ketogenic state, and this is only broken by us having a carb-rich meal. I'm a rower and have indeed noticed that I am perfectly happy to do steady state work in the morning on an empty stomach, but for any of the hit, I just cannot summon up the speed unless I have a meal beforehand. Is this because I'm in ketosis when I wake up? God, I can't read or talk today at all. I thought that it took many weeks of very low carb living to get keto adapted. I eat high carb paleo plus dairy and occasional legumes. Just wondered what your thoughts were and whether, if I need to do high intensity stuff in the morning, I need to have a high carb meal the night before. Cheers.
So, you know, all of this stuff is a spectrum. Like if you are training exceptionally hard, like if you're in the throes actually of like a rowing event, you could be carb topped off like crazy. You could be sipping on, you know, like a maltodextrin beverage, but because your work output is so high, your body is trying to find energy substrates anywhere it can. And so we would actually, even with a relatively high carbohydrate content in your blood and, you know, insulin levels and all that, we would see some decently high beta hydroxybutyrate, some ketone bodies floating around because your body is just trying to get shit done, like by hook or by crook. And, and, you know, the overnight fast, you will tend to see people go, particularly healthy, I'll put a caveat on this, people who are healthy, we will see them dip into ketosis because, it, you know, the blood sugar starts kind of titrating down in the liver. We start running more and more off of body fat and the fat starts funneling into the liver and gets converted into ketone bodies. And this should be a really normal process. The people who have problems with this typically have some sort of insulin resistance, metabolic derangement, and then we may see a cortisol release early in the morning, 2 a.m., 3 a.m., something along those lines, which will actually pull you out of sleep. And the what's happening there is the body is trying to boost glucose levels back up to maintain normal brain functioning and all that sort of stuff. So this ability to kind of cycle back and forth is very, very healthy. And what we're talking about with keto adaptation, like a la Finney and Volek, Art and Science of Low Carbohydrate Eating, is a completely different story, where we're really pinning down the amount of carbohydrate, really goosing the substrate towards that fat ketosis-centric activity, and it takes some time for the body to adapt to that. And there's actually another question, I think the very next question, on how reversible is ketosis, and I guess I'll just kind of leave it at that for right now, because this other question we will run amok on this topic here in just a few moments. But is there anything else? Oh, and if you're going to do high intensity stuff in the morning, do you need a high carb meal the night before? I would say probably yes. And fortunately now have tracked down a good jiu-jitsu school, and not only is it good, but they have some old dude professional hours, which means AM time instead of just typical Brazilian time, which classes start rolling about 8 or 9 o'clock at night after all the other legitimate successful businesses have closed up and left the mats open. So I will, if I know that I'm doing a pretty hard session in the AM, I'd go either typically 8 a.m. if I'm rolling at that time, 8 or 8:30, then I just have a little bit of decaf coffee, maybe a little bit of cream in it, and that's it, and then do some water beforehand. And so that's a largely fasted state deal, which the night before I typically do a pretty good carb meal so that both the muscle glycogen and the liver glycogen is reasonably topped off. And I feel just a little bit lethargic when I first get going in the AM, but then once I get rolling, I actually feel really good. Like, that's probably the best time, best fueling structure, whatever that I have for rolling.
Sweet.
Yeah.
All right. How reversible is ketosis? Dan says, hello, Rob and Greg. I would like to start by kissing your butts and telling you how wonderful the content is. I drive an hour to and from work each day, and it makes my drive rather enjoyable. Thanks, Dan.
Nice.
Here's my question. I'm researching the ketogenic diet and have read both The Art and Science of Low Carb Living and Low Carb Performance by Dr. Volek and Dr. Finney. It's pretty clear that the only way to create keto-adapted state is to be uber strict on all forms of carbohydrate, eat moderate amounts of protein, and a boatload of fat. I also understand that the transition will take 2 to 3 weeks to fully adapt and another realistic 4 to 6 weeks to optimize efficiency and see legit changes in body comp and performance. My question is, once the ketogenic state is established, does it take just as much diligence to reverse the effects? Does the body revert back to a glucose-dependent metabolic state quicker than a ketogenic? Am I doomed to never eat a sweet potato or serving a fruit larger than half cup per day for the rest of my life if I want to remain sexy? Sarcasm aside, my goals are pure aesthetic, and I don't want to flush 2 months worth of work down the toilet because I ate a sweet potato after a hard CrossFit workout. I'm 5'8", 176 pounds, 15% body fat with a goal of 9% body fat. I follow strict autoimmune paleo protocols with no cheating. I perform 2 CrossFit workouts a week at my local, quote, box. 1 standard strength session a week at my health club, and I alternate those days with 30 minutes of steady-state cardio at a Zone 2 intensity, confirmed through metabolic testing, and mobility stuff via Kelly Starrett. Thank you for your time.
Wow. So what's the main question here, I guess?
The main question is how quickly would he go back to a non-ketogenic metabolic state by eating some carbohydrates? If he spent 2 months getting fully keto adapted and he ate 1 extra strawberry, would he be suddenly rocketed back to the carbohydrate
Fatland,
metabolism?
Back to chubby Chubbsville? Yeah, this is an interesting thing, is that the body does tend to and want being highly anthropomorphized and all the hoity-toity engineering-oriented scientists out there will cringe at me saying this, but whatever, quit listening to the podcast. So the body really does seem to goose out of ketosis if it's given the slightest opportunity to do so. If we eat too much protein, if we eat too much carbohydrate, the body will tend to pop out of ketosis rather quickly, and you know, that's just kind of an interesting thing. I had some commentary about that in my three-part series on my thoughts on low carb and paleo. You know, that said, however, following Peter Attia's you know, kind of experience eating a ketogenic diet for the last 2 years, what he's found is as time has gone on, he can actually eat more protein, eat more carbs, and he tends to still stay in ketosis. And I forget where he is at now, but I think it's somewhere, you know, 150 grams of protein a day, something like maybe 100 grams of carbs on most days or some days. And he's still quite ketogenic. And but this is on the backside of having been like super low carb, like 30 grams, 50 grams of carbs a day, maybe 100 to 120 grams of protein a day for a long time, and really goosing that fat adaptation pathway. So you know, it's interesting. The longer you seem to be, you know, legitimately heading towards ketosis, the more the body kind of adapts in that direction. In the interim, it seems like the body does kind of slide out rather quickly. But this is where some of the cyclic low carb stuff, you know, a la Mauro Di Pasquale and some other people that have popularized like phase shift diets, you do, you know, within a day, maybe 2 days, you do tend to drop back into a solid ketogenic state, particularly if you're using some MCT oil like coconut oil and stuff like that. So, you know, there's a lot of there's a lot of latitude on this, whether we're talking about you know, the ultimate amount of carbohydrate or fat you can take in and still remain ketogenic. Also, your activity level is very, very important in that story. The fact that you're doing some CrossFit, even if it's only 2 days a week, I've got to say...
Okay, folks, we're back. Thought my internet was fixed. It's not. So awesome times. Greg and I were trying to use Skype again, but we're back to our backup option. So I have no idea what I was just talking about. You know, there's just a spectrum of keto adaptation based on activity level and everything. I think where I was headed was, you know, when we know how glycogen demanding CrossFit is, It just, you know, at this stage of the game, it just makes me nervous. Anybody following an autoimmune or a ketogenic approach and doing CrossFit. I know some folks do it. If you've got an autoimmune condition, and that, you know, like Dr. Terry Walls has mentioned, that not only does she need to be grain, legume, dairy free, but she also needs to be ketogenic to be able to deal with her multiple sclerosis scenario. In that situation, I would really consider lifting weights, doing some low-level cardio. Like I would avoid the really glycogen-demanding type workouts if that's the way that you need to eat to be healthy. Just my own personal opinion. Was mentioned in here, 5'8", 176 pounds, 15% body fat with a goal, 9% body fat. You can reach that with, you know, high protein, moderate to high carbs, particularly taking advantage of post-workout carbs. Keep fat very, very low. Don't really add any additional fat until you get down to lean body fat levels, and then you titrate the fat up a little bit for maintenance, and then you should be good to go. So there are other ways to get lean besides just the ketogenic approach. Some people, though, if they have shift work or other things going on, then, you know, we've got those considerations, and you might need something ketogenic or quasi-ketogenic. But yeah, that's all I've got to say on that. I'm just completely buggered by my internet.
Sweet.
Totally buggered. Yeah. Okay. All next right. One.
Let's see here. Now I'm all confused.
I think we're on the ProVigil one.
ProVigil. Let's see here. Hey, Rob, love the podcast. If only you and Greg were in England to change the attitudes of the obese and ignorant we have here. My question is about the drug ProVigil, and specifically use in people who don't suffer from narcolepsy. I've heard that it's used in the military. That could be false, and was wanting your views on the substance, any potential positives and negatives. Keep up the good work, guys.
Gosh, you know, ProVigil is one of the few, I would say, beneficial kind of sleep oriented drugs that we have out there. Like all of the, if you've listened to Doc Parsley's stuff, and I know some people got to come out and see both he and I speak at the Nevada Museum of Art, and he went through his sleep talk that he typically does more or less for the SEALs, and you know, things like Ambien and all the related kind of sleep aid drugs, the antihistamines that are used as sleep aids, they make you unconscious. They don't really put you into deep restorative sleep. And particularly with the Ambien, like it's pretty no bueno stuff at the end of the day. Like you don't establish normal sleep architecture. You don't have all the refilling and replenishing of your brain's neurotransmitters and the resetting of your immune function and whatnot. And so it's just not all that great. But the Provigil is really, really interesting in that it seems to legitimately mitigate, maybe even reverse some of these effects of, say, like neurotransmitter depletion due to sleeplessness, some of the pro-inflammatory effects. Particularly, it seems like a kind of cerebrovascular inflammation that we tend to see with sleep deprivation. So Provigil is one of these very interesting items that seems to be pretty beneficial. It is, I don't know if it's a Schedule II item, but it's monitored in the whole, you know, pharmaceutical scene because it does have some addictive potential. It has a little bit of a speedy element to it and stuff like that. So it is monitored in that regard. When Zoe was first born, I actually got a script for Provigil because I knew in reading up on it that the stuff would be pretty helpful for dealing, you know, with the really gnarly nighttime, you know, the recovery from like a gnarly nighttime of sleeplessness, and try to help me get through that first month and everything. And because I use a health savings account, just a little plug for that stuff, even though those are probably all going away. So I don't really have a prescription plan. So basically a health savings account with that stuff, you pay cash and carry for everything. And when I went in to grab the month supply of this stuff, the pharmacist looked at me and she was like, "So you have an HSA?" I'm like, "Yeah." And she's all, "Well, it's $1,500
for a month."
And I was like, "Dude, Viagra isn't that expensive." And she's like, "Yeah." And so, you know, it's there's all kinds of interesting kind of politics and reasons behind that, which is probably better on the controversial truth than it is on here. But the stuff is pretty helpful. It you know, can be, in my opinion, pretty beneficial for the right person under the right circumstances. It does have some addictive abuse potential associated with it, so you have to keep that in mind. And at the end of the day, this is still a stopgap measure. Like, you can't live like an asshole and take this stuff and have it just absolve you of all of the downside and the you know, deleterious effects. Like, if you have to do, you know, a cross-country drive, or you're flying to Europe or something like that, and you know you're going to be hammered from sleep debt, I think that you could make a really good argument for using a couple of doses of Provigil, obviously under your doctor's guidance and, you know, blah, 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 all the exculpatory clauses. But, you know, you have to figure the stuff out and make sure it's appropriate for you and work with the doc and everything. But I think that there are some very solid, you know, kind of off-label uses for this stuff that totally makes sense. And you know, like with what Doc Parsley has talked about with you know, again, this is chronic stuff. So we want to fix the chronic sleep debt that people have and save something like Provigil more for acute sleep problems. Like if you're traveling, if you have a new baby and you're just like, you know, okay, a couple of days a week, I've just got to have something that's going to help me a little bit so that, you know, I can get some laundry done and stuff like that. I think that there are probably some arguments for that. But again, we need to plug the holes in our general sleep story so that it doesn't kill us young. So,
man, $1,500.
Yeah, I was like, oh,
that was for a month's supply.
That was for a month's supply, which I was figuring like 30 tablets would actually probably last me over a year because I would just kind of use it, you know, kind of selectively. But I was like, I don't know that I need it that badly. So, but you know, it just as an aside, that is one of the, you know, but if I was in some sort of a, you know, aggressive prescription drug plan, then then people will say, well, my insurance picks it up. Yeah, your insurance does, but then you're paying this insanely inflated price. I did a little poking around on the internet and what the price should be when you consider manufacturing costs and all that sort of jive is probably about like $6 a month.
Shocker.
But this is an example where you're dealing with a very, with the whole like narcolepsy and sleep apnea and stuff like that, a highly medicalized usage for this drug. And then also there's a little bit of an addiction potential to it. So that ends up, popping the price up a little bit. But, it's another one of these things where the U.S. has a very, very goofy medical system. We'll just leave it at that for right now.
Okay.
And moving on to more drugs, ADHD meds.
Yeah, this guy's name here is awesome. You have to read it. It's Addled, but it's Addled. ADD is the way it's spelled. Capital ADD, as in attention deficit disorder. Just read it. Hi, guys. Big fan of the podcast here. I've been struggling recently with some training issues and that I have found to be problematic. I was diagnosed with ADD when I was a kid, and since then I've been off and on CNS stimulant meds throughout most of my adulthood. Recently, because of demands of my new job, I decided to go back on Adderall after 5 years med-free. During my drug hiatus, I took up CrossFit, Olympic lifting, and running, and I've seen tremendous gains in athleticism. Basically, I'm 38 and can now kick my 22-year-old's ass. Whoa. However, since I have been back on Adderall, I've noticed that I can't really push the red line as much as I used to be able to. Maybe it's me just getting older, but I feel like I don't quite have the fire that I did even 6 months ago. I don't want to stop taking Adderall because my productivity has significantly improved, but I also want to maintain my intensity of my past workouts. Plus, I am more prone to feeling nauseous during my workouts than I have been since I've begun. I've tried to take a reduced dose on days that I work out and only in the morning, but that doesn't seem to work. This week, I'm also trying to go drug-free to see if there's a difference, but now I'm writing you a podcast question instead of working. Do you have suggestions regarding this issue from a training perspective? I know that you think that you need to drink a lot of water and remember to eat, which I do, but do CNS stimulants adversely affect testosterone? And if so, are there potential supplemental correctives, or do I just sacrifice intensity for peace of mind at work?
You know, I don't know that we even need to go down the endocrine pathway, androgen hormone pathway to get some deleterious effects on performance. What you're doing with some stuff like Adderall, I mean, it's quite similar to methamphetamine. There's some differences there, but some of the effects are similar. And so part of the problem that you're going to have with high intensity work output is similar to simply drinking too much coffee. Like if you graph the ergogenic threshold of caffeine consumption, it's rather a small dose, like 100 milligrams, 50 to 100 milligrams, which an average cup of coffee can have like 250 milligrams. An average cup of coffee from like Starbucks can have like 15,000 milligrams, it seems like. So, what it does, epinephrine, norepinephrine, or caffeine, which stimulates the release or works as a mimetic to adrenaline, epinephrine, norepinephrine, it changes cardiotonicity, the way that the heart pumps blood, the way that it fills, the way that, the ejection fraction leaves the heart. And we end up with an optimization in that story, like a little bit, being a little bit wired up, a little bit ramped up, improves that whole, cardiac output kind of story, which is part of why when we exercise, we increase catecholamine release. And part of it is modulating immune response. And part of it is improving cardiac function. And other elements of it are shuttling blood away from the gut and towards the muscles and, on and on and on. Like there's all these parallel functions going on. But if you overstimulate with caffeine, you actually get a downregulation or not a downregulation, but a deleterious effect on cardiac output. Like the heart is, for lack of better terms, it's almost like spazzing out. Like it's not relaxing long enough to get a full left ventricular fill. And then you get that ejection fraction that's nice and burly and kind of like squirting somebody with a super soaker or something like that. Like it's more like a spastic sprinkler. And Adderall is going to have some similar effects as one kind of mechanism going on here. Another mechanism is that And there's just kind of an unfortunate downside to this, but you know, we have, I don't want to describe this, like a certain pool of stress that we can deal with. You know, and you throw everything into that: exercise, dealing with kids, financial stress, you know, being creative and working. And when you start digging into any one of these things to a deeper degree, then you have less reserves for other activity. So it sounds like you're being more productive at work, probably a little more creative, you know, but you're putting some more skull sweat into work. And that means just by extension, you will have less recovery ability. There will be fewer neurotransmitters available, less neurological function, less immune function available to allocate into really hard training. And that's just the way it is. And I, you know, there may be some other, you know, pharmacopoeia that you could go down. Like, you know, as we need to start getting a cut from Vinny at Planet Muscle and you know, get in on some of his action. But, you know, you might be able to do some tinkering on those axes, like, you know, finding a anti-aging doc and really looking at testosterone and DHEA levels and growth hormone and all that. But I think at the end of the day, what we're talking about here is just that you've reallocated a significant amount of your resources into work and creativity, and you've just got less left over. And, you know, when I wrote my book, I had a good 4 months where, you know, I got up in the morning, made a cup of coffee, drove to an office that I had rented in downtown Chico. And in this 400 square foot office, all that there was a chair and a table. And like, I brought my wireless internet connection with me, and that was it. And I sat and worked all day long, like 6 to 8 hours of writing. And people talk about writing for 6 to 8 hours, but they usually don't. They usually fritter around and fart around, and I'm just as guilty of that. But when I was writing my book, like I did a legitimate, like I wasn't on social media. That's what I was doing. I wasn't in the gym. And I tell you, when I was done with that, I was knackered, like smashed. And I would still try to do some exercise, but it was like my soul had been sucked through my nostrils or something. And I think that that's just kind of a reality. So, you know, I think taking some things like some adaptogens like rhodiola or any of the good, you know, blended adaptogens, Gaia Herbs has some pretty cool adrenal adaptogens and stuff like that, some adrenal blends. But I think it's just kind of a reality that if you're going to work really, really hard mentally, you are not going to have as much capacity to work really, really hard physically. And that's just the reality. And, you know, clearly youth will give you a little bit more of a buffer against that. But I think that's true even when we're younger. And as we get older, then that story just gets more and more pronounced.
Yeah. I can attest to those effects.
So that was a long, drawn-out way of saying we can't have it all.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see here. Gluten cutter ad in Women's World this week. You wrote this, didn't you, Rob? You read Women's World.
Yep.
Carol says, "Hi, Rob. I was wondering if you can comment in your blog on this new product I'm seeing a full-page ad for in this week's Women's World Weekly. It sounds dangerous to me. Not sure how it works. Are they saying they can cure celiac/gluten sensitivity? Cheers." And there's, of course, a link for us.
Yeah, and it's like these crackers. And I for the love of God, I tried and tried and tried to find what the ingredients were. I even used this wacky thing called Google and put in gluten cutter ingredients. And I'll be damned if I can find the ingredients on this thing. But it's claiming that gluten cutter has enzymes that help break down gluten. I would assume that means proleal endopeptidases that break down these high proline containing items. But since I can't actually get, they have no easy access to here's the science or anything like that. You know, it's interesting though, the site still, you know, recommends how to reduce gluten in the diet and what are gluten containing foods and what are some sneaky gluten containing foods, you know, like soy sauce and stuff. So it's actually not horrible on kind of an educational standpoint, but then the implication there that you could eat a cracker and this is going to largely solve your gluten intolerance stuff. It's a little dodgy. It's a little nerve-wracking. I would love to see some some stool samples of folks that standardized meals containing gluten with and without this, you know, maybe 10 days without and then 10 days with, and somebody collects the poo and runs some PCR or something, or not PCR, but some gel electrophoresis on this and separate out the proteins and see what type of proteins we have floating around in there and see if the gliadin. But, you know, even within that story, talking with Matt Lalonde, like there seem to be hundreds of proteins that are potentially immunogenic in kind of wheat, rye, oats, barley, all that stuff. So I don't know. I mean, if you know that you're reactive, I just don't know that this stuff is all that smart of an item. And it's maybe a little irresponsible when we know how sick people can get from gluten intolerance and celiac and all that stuff and some of the, you know, broad acting neurological effects. We know that, gluten sensitivity is a high likelihood predisposing factor for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and, you know, a host of other problems, gallbladder issues. So it's kind of dodgy, but also on the other side of this, it's kind of buyer beware. You know, the information is out there. If people don't take the time to educate themselves on it, then I guess kind of bad on them, but I don't know. So yeah, gluten cutter, not really my best idea. And Carol, there are better publications than Women's World out there. If you want me to hook you up with a subscription to the performance menu, I will do it, but you have to promise to not read Women's World anymore. We have to move you on to at least People or something else.
Wow. Yeah. That's if that's a step up for you, I'm sad. Okay. Sprinter or long, slow distance? This Chris says, "Hi, Rob and Greg. Thanks for tackling my question, which is of dubious relevance." Well, most of our answers are of even more dubious relevance. Much has been said of the duality of certain exercise types and phenotypes, fast twitch muscle fiber versus slow touch, high intensity interval training versus long, slow distance, etc. I wonder if you guys think this may apply to our lifestyle / occupation types as well. I mean, are some of us better suited to professions that are, quote, fast twitch, i.e. professions in which there are explosive periods of activity punctuated by rather long periods of downtime? For example, ER doctor, consultants who are on the road for a while and then back home, soldiers, wait staff, etc. Or are some of us suited to the long, slow grind of retail, shutter, teaching, research, etc.? Jobs in which the schedule is fixed, the hours predictable, and the tasks ones more of endurance and longevity. You know, like marriage. of course, some of us are suited personality-wise to one or the other, but have you ever thought that there may be a physiological reason why some are drawn to one side of the spectrum or the other? I would just like to hear you and Greg pontificate, or rather, Rob pontificate and Greg dismiss it as a stupid question. Smiley face. Thanks, fellas. I've never done such a thing.
They know us so well. It's like they've listened before. There's this personality typing test called the Myers-Briggs, and it's kind of developed out of, I think some of the Jungian psychology, but it gets a little bit... almost like astrology kind of deal, like some of the really geeked out elements of it, you know, they go a little bit out in the bushes. But I think that out of the whole thing, they give you like a four letter personality type, like I'm an ENTP, extrovert, intuitive, thinking, perceptive, and you know, there's supposed to be all these characteristics with that. But out of any of those things, the first letter, the introvert versus extrovert, I think is pretty helpful and pretty telling. And it's not it's saying whether or not you're friendly or unfriendly, but it's how you get energy. And like, we all know people who, if you make them sit down and read a book and be alone, like they will scratch at the walls and die because they've just got to have an audience. They need to be the center of attention. They need people around them. And then we know other folks that if they are, you know, thrust into a group of people, maybe they can do it, maybe they can motor through it, but at the end of the event, they're exhausted and tired and kind of lethargic, and their batteries are recharged by like going for a walk and reading a book and just having some downtime, watching some TV. And so I think that introvert-extrovert deal is actually a really, really helpful guide. And it's actually something that when people have pinged us about opening gyms, both Nikki and I have asked this question, have you done a Myers-Briggs test? And, you know, if they haven't, then we ask them, you know, have you ever noticed, are you kind of enlivened by being around a group of people, or do you feel lethargic? And I can't tell you how many people we ran across who ended up liking training. And, you know, particularly, you know, they liked CrossFit. They liked doing all the, you know, mixed modal gymnastic stuff and everything. So they're like, oh, I'm going to open a gym. And then you start poking around on the person and they're a huge introvert. And so it's not to say you shouldn't open a gym in that situation, but you should probably have some sort of an extrovert in the chain of command to deal with a lot of the day-to-day stuff. Great. I would put both Greg and my wife, Nikki, in more of the gregarious introvert side, where they can be a lot of fun. They're fun to hang out with. They can be engaging, but I would stick both you guys in that category of, you would rather have like a really small, quiet kind of gathering, where I would stick myself more in that extrovert deal, where if you stick me in front of 50 or 500 people and it's kind of like, you know, three ring circus, like I love that. And I can do that, you know, 7 days a week, 8 hours a day. And I tend to just like spin up more and more and more from that process. So I think that that's one big thing. And then another piece is, are you a really detail oriented person, or are you more kind of idea oriented person, which everybody wants to be an idea person. And then we need detail oriented people to get shit done. But, you know, I think that the introvert extrovert deal is a piece. I know this is kind of going away from the question about like, are you sprinters versus, you know, grinders. I think a lot of that stuff plays into whether or not people have like a risk aversion versus kind of a risk predilection. People who go into business, I would say, have a little bit more of a risk predilection. Like they're willing to give up some stability and some known for the potential of having, you know, something better or something else, or maybe just something kind of more under their own control. And then there are people that are so risk averse. We've had a number of employees like this where we will lay out a potential path for these folks where they could maybe double their income by being a little bit entrepreneurial within the gym or within some other activity that we have going on. And it so freaks them out because there's not somebody babysitting them, telling them, okay, you clock in at this time, do these 10 tasks, and then clock out at this time, and this is what you get paid. And that's been a learning experience as a business owner, is trying to figure out what type of people are what. And it's remarkably rare the number of people that you can throw an entrepreneurial opportunity at them and not have them shit the bed on it. It's actually kind of surprising to me. Just as an aside, Greg, any thoughts on all this stuff?
Yeah, I agree. we've definitely had the same experience with employees, and there is a shocking lack of self motivation and willingness to not even take risk, but to just knuckle down and put in the work. You know what I mean? I don't personally get it, but yes, I would say that this Chris is onto something, that certainly people are attracted to professions as they are attracted to exercise. Although that doesn't, I don't know. I would have to think about that a little more. I don't know if they necessarily correspond to one another in a given person, but they might. Maybe at the extreme ends of the spectrum, they probably do.
Right. You know, I actually, just as an interesting aside, I don't see a ton of super high-powered corporate execs. Like the only people I'm thinking of kind of this that are more like bodybuilder-y, powerlifting kind of oriented, the two people that come to mind are like Bill Phillips and Arnold Schwarzenegger, where it seems like every stinking CEO, billionaire type that I've known or I've worked with a few, they're cardio junkies. And like yeah. The longer, the better. And I would say actually that folks who have kind of a powerlifting sprinting predilection, I would label us as kind of lazy bastards for the most part. Like, I would, you know, and it's for me too, it's kind of an interesting thing. Like I feel like, I did a lot of internal work in my 20s to 30s, and you know, I think dealt with some demons of coming from like a poor family, a family with some mixed legal background, shall we say, and just, you know, some you know, kind of trying to figure out what type of person I was and all that sort of stuff and what's important to me. And now at this point, like I make good money and I enjoy the work that I do, but I drive a Subaru Forester that I bought with cash 5 years ago, and I'm going to drive it until I have 250,000 miles on it or until I start getting major problems with it. And it's interesting. A lot of the CEO types that I've seen, some people who are very, very successful, very driven, there's an interesting flip to that. And Sam Harris actually had a really interesting article kind of talking about this stuff. But super, super high achievers are oftentimes not that happy of people. There's some broken element to their psyche where, you know, they've got to always prove, they've got to always achieve, you know, they can't rest on their laurels or, you know, whatever the stuff is. But fundamentally, in my opinion, they're not all that comfortable in their own skin. And you know,
they just want you to love them, Rob.
They just want you to love
it's
them.
It's just never enough for you.
But it's interesting. I remember after Steve Jobs died, there was some discussion about his childhood and how he had been adopted and like very, very loving adoptive family. But the fact that Jobs had been adopted, that always was a thorny issue for him. And apparently maybe about 2 months before he died, the biological father of Steve Jobs tried to reach out to him and, you know, just wanted to like go out to coffee with him. And Jobs wouldn't do it. He didn't want to meet him. And so, you know, and so would Steve Jobs have been the person that he was if he hadn't been adopted and there hadn't been that you know, kind of chink in his psyche potentially of wondering, well, why did my parents give me up and, you know, all that sort of stuff. It's very hypothetical, you know, stuff, but it's kind of interesting. And I feel like I'm a pretty happy person. And, you know, the main thing that drives me at this point is some knowledge that I think I and we collectively have some information that could help a lot of people, could save a lot of lives, could save a lot of money, could mitigate a lot of suffering. And I tell you that the day that I feel like that message is out there or there's enough of a vanguard ahead of me that I don't need to beat some of these, you know, the drums on the medical side and everything. Like I'm going to coach the strength and conditioning of an MMA gym and do a lot more time just hanging out with my kids. And that's what I'm going to do. And I will make less money. I will have less, quote, you know, prominence or whatever, but I'll be completely okay with that. Like the main thing that drives me right now is I really legitimately feel like we have some information that if we share to the broader scene that it's going to save a lot of lives, save a lot of money, maybe help improve medicine. But the day that there's enough of a vanguard ahead of me that this message can keep marching forward, like I'm pulling the ripcord out and I'm doing more stuff that I really, really like. And I like this stuff, but I've been doing it 15 years. And I actually just like hanging out in the gym and training people. Like I really, really enjoy that. Having that day-to-day personal interaction, which, you know, being a coach, you get to have a little bit of that, you know, the gym is your theater, as it were. And so you get to go in and do your performance art doing that stuff. And it's kind of cool.
Sweet.
That was a long answer to a kind of random question, I guess.
Well, he asked to hear you pontificate.
That's true.
So you aim to please.
You know, this last one is the number 8. I think we're actually probably good. These last two are really long. Maybe we can shuffle those into a subsequent podcast.
All right.
What do you think of that, Tiger?
Yep.
Sound good? Okay.
I'm for it.
Anything else that folks should be aware of?
Let's see here. No, I think we covered it. Performance menu, Catalyst Athletics coaching certification and gym affiliation program. That's it.
Bunny Ranch. It's all good. Cool.
Yeah.
Cool, cool. All right, dude. Well, congrats on the launching of your certification and your affiliation program. Honored to be a part of that and really looking forward to see how folks get in and start taking that on. That'll be awesome.
Indeed.
Cool. All right. We'll talk to you soon.
See ya.
Later, G. Bye.